This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the upcoming election with a focus on the voting process and how things might be different this time around. If you have questions or comments on our show today, we are on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, 866-476-3881. Joining me now are two guests. Barbara Tully is president of Indiana Vote by Mail. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you.
Shelley Brown is vice president of Indiana Vote by Mail. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, Matt. Thank you for having us today.
Barbara, we talked to you both about a month ago, but can you remind our listeners what Indiana Vote by Mail is?
Sure. Indiana Vote by Mail is a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization that is dedicated to bringing about voting reform that gives voters choices in Indiana about the way we vote. All choices about the way we vote. We want to see vote by mail enacted in a serious and rigorous way with safety and security, as we know it can be done. And we still need in-person polling places. There are voters who want to choose to vote that way, or voters who are disabled that need to vote that way for whatever reason. But the point is, we want voters to be able to have choices in the way that they vote.
Now, a number of people, a good amount of people, voted by mail in the Indiana primary, which, of course, was postponed from May to June. It was the primary. It wasn't the general. So I think asking this question is important. How does voting by mail work? How do you do it?
So voting by mail in Indiana means people have to apply for an absentee ballot. And in the June primary, those excuses were waived so that anyone could apply for an absentee ballot for the June primary. You didn't need to say, I'm going to be gone from the county, I'm going to be at my place of work, I'm disabled, I'm whatever. You didn't have to use any of those reasons. Everybody could apply for an absentee ballot. The Indiana Election Commission and the Secretary of State have not waived those reasons for the general election. So now in Indiana, you need to use one of those excuses in order to apply for an absentee ballot. And we're encouraging people to do that right away. You can go online to indianavoters.in.gov and apply for an absentee ballot today if you qualify. In vote by mail states, though, the way this works in a fully realized mailed voting practice, all registered voters are sent a ballot, not an application, an actual ballot, and they vote the ballot at their kitchen table, and then they return the ballot in a number of ways. They return it by mail, they return it out of drop boxes, they return it to polling centers or early vote centers or polling locations on election day. So it's often called vote at home because people don't return their ballot in the mail. They actually, most voters in those states actually return it in another way. But it does show in states where vote by mail is done that the voter turnout rates are much higher than we see in Indiana. I'm not going to say every registered voter in a state like Oregon or Washington that have been doing it for years and years has 100% voter turnout. No state has 100% voter turnout, but they certainly have higher voter turnout than we do in Indiana.
Shelley, Indiana Vote by Mail was among a group that requested a preliminary injunction that would force the expansion of mail-in voting in Indiana during the pandemic. Before we get to the decision made by a judge last week, can you explain what effect this would have had in practice?
Well, it would allow all of the voters in Indiana to again be able to vote by mail. That's what we were asking for, because as we all know, the pandemic has not gone away. And who knows what conditions are going to be like on election day. And the clerks really need time to plan and get the materials and equipment that they need to be able to do an effective job for the election. So we were pushing early on to have this preliminary injunction so that clerks could plan for an increased mail ballot election in November and give everybody the ability to vote safely from their home.
Have other states successfully expanded mail-in voting specifically by doing something like this?
Yes. So there are, I'm going to lose the count because this like changes daily and it's hard to keep up with all of the news. But I think Indiana now is only one of six states that is requiring voters to declare a reason for applying for an absentee ballot. And that has changed significantly. It used to be that there were like 23 no excuse states. I might have the numbers wrong, but it's directionally correct. And now we're up to, you know, there's six states left that are making voters declare a reason: Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, you know, Alabama, Texas. I'm missing a state, but you get the idea. So there has been quite a bit of movement in terms of states adjusting just this year to what the conditions are because of the pandemic. I mean, California, with its 20 million voters, has gone to full vote by mail for the November election. They've been transitioning county by county for a number of years. I think Nevada and New Hampshire are going to mail ballots to all voters. Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Utah, Hawaii have already been vote by mail states, some of those for a number of years. Some of them are newer to it. So there are states that are really doing the right things by enfranchising voters. And I don't know, in Indiana, we seem intent on not doing that.
We're talking with Barbara Tully, president of Indiana Vote by Mail. We also have Shelley Brown, vice president of Indiana Vote by Mail. And today we're talking about the upcoming election with a focus on the voting process and how things might be different this time around. So, Shelley, last week, getting back to what the judge said, the federal judge ruled against the order to expand mail-in voting. In the decision, he wrote, and this is a quote, "Some states have chosen no excuse voting by mail for all. Indiana has decided otherwise. The question here, however, is not whether the policy is wise, but whether it is unconstitutional," end quote. What did you make of this decision and the reasoning he gave for it? Barb?
Well, we thought it was a very poor decision, number one. It is unconstitutional, and there are two claims that we make as part of the argument. One is a 14th Amendment claim of equal protection because of the conditions of the pandemic, and some voters are treated differently than others. And the other is a 26th Amendment claim of age discrimination that doesn't allow voters under 65 to apply for an absentee ballot if they don't qualify in any of the other categories. So for a voter like me who is under 65, I can't apply for an absentee ballot by virtue of my age, and that is age discrimination. I mean, the 26th Amendment says you can't deny or abridge anyone 18 or over the right to vote, and it's being abridged on me and the number of other voters in Indiana we maintain. So we think it is unconstitutional, and we think the judge's decision was poor. But we did file an appeal in federal court. What's today? Thursday. We did that on Tuesday. That is expected to be expedited through the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago.
Shelley, how would you characterize thoughts about expanding mail-in voting from members of the Indiana Election Commission?
It seems pretty evenly split between the Democrats and the Republicans. I know at the recent election meeting that it was 2-2 vote against considering expanding vote by mail in Indiana. So it seems pretty evenly split along party lines.
So it is on party lines. It is a partisan issue.
Yes, it is. And it shouldn't be. Studies and polls show that an overwhelming number of people support vote by mail. So it doesn't really reflect the will of the people, you know, overwhelmingly people and people on both sides, because I read articles, I read things online from both sides, people that had the ability to vote by mail in the June primary. People love it. You know, people love it.
Barbara, how safe and secure are elections in Indiana right now?
Well, they are safe and secure. Our county clerks do an awesome job with their election staff to run elections in Indiana. Mail voting is inherently safe because it's done on signature comparison. You know, you sign ballot envelope, and please, if people have, you know, done an absentee ballot this year, please remember to sign your absentee ballot envelope. But that's what the safety and security is. So they're comparing your signature on the envelope to other signatures that they have on file, like from your voter registration. That's done a little bit easier way in Indiana, in vote by mail states than it is in Indiana. You can use software to aid that so election workers can do that comparison more easily. But That's the safety and security of veiled elections. I think the more concern that people have, the greater concern that people have is, making sure their ballot gets back in time.
How do you respond to people who argue that mail-in voting is especially vulnerable to fraud?
That is a false argument. I mean, I could cite study after academic study after academic study that shows that vote by mail is no more prone to fraud than in-person voting. It's a false flag that people float. It's just not true.
Shelley, your group conducted a survey of voters after the June primary. What'd you find out?
Well, we found out that 83%, when we asked people, if you voted by mail, would you vote by mail again? And this is an unscientific survey, but 83% of our survey respondents said that they would vote by mail again. And 13% would prefer to vote in person, which I think is pretty typical of what we see in other states that have gone to the vote by mail system. That's why we want to make sure when we go to a vote by mail system that we don't take away the option for people to vote in person.
Barbara Tully, what are some of your long-term legislative goals?
So we have things that we would like to work on, like getting no excuse absentee passed legislatively. And in fact, there was a bill, I think it was two legislative sessions ago, that went through the Indiana Senate that said, okay, let's get rid of the excuses. And as we know, there's a supermajority, so it was supported by Republicans then. And then it got to the House and it died in committee. So no excuse absentee, permanent no excuse absentee, which is kind of the next step in the process. So, okay, fine, make me apply for an absentee ballot once, but give me a box to check to say I always want my ballot that way in future. So that permanent absentee is kind of the next step along the way to full vote by mail. We need to deal with some legislation around drop boxes. Vote by mail states place special drop boxes. They look nothing like post office boxes. They look very different. For voters to be able to drive up and drop their ballots in. So we need to deal with that legislatively. So those are some of the main priorities that we would have.
Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us in this first segment. Barbara Tully is president of Indiana Vote by Mail. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you for having us.
Shelley Brown is vice president of Indiana Vote by Mail. Thanks to you, Shelley.
Good to be with you, Matt.
We'll be back after a quick break to talk more about the upcoming election and the voting process with a live panel of political science experts. If you have questions or comments for our guests, we're on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelzer, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the voting process in the upcoming election, and we would love your questions and comments on the topic. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation today, so call 866-476-3881 and leave us a voicemail. We're joined live now by four guests. Sheila Kennedy is a professor at the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI. Welcome to you, Sheila. Elizabeth Bennion is a professor of political science at Indiana University, South Bend. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Glad to be here.
Matthew Baghetta is an associate professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Matthew, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Marjorie Hershey is professor emeritus of political science at Indiana University. Welcome back, Marjorie.
Thank you very much.
Sheila, how do we increase voter turnout during a pandemic?
Well, I think that the two women you interviewed about mail-in voting, I'm a huge advocate for that, and I think that they certainly pointed out. I know the last time I looked at Oregon's turnout, it was like 80%, and of course, Indiana has routinely been in the bottom 10%. Or bottom 10 states, pardon me, with voter turnout. And in 2014, I think we were dead last. So the better convenience of being able to vote by mail certainly encourages people to do two things. First of all, if you've got your ballot at your home and you want to look something up or find out what a candidate said about an issue that concerns you, you aren't stuck in a voting booth with a line behind you. You can do that. So the likelihood of casting informed ballots certainly increases, and the likelihood of just voting increases. So I think, as so many states have now found, long term, that has to be the answer. But the other thing that will help turnout is vote centers and early voting. And I would hope that those of us in Indiana who can vote in person would do so early and therefore contribute to the likelihood that we will get a firm answer on who won and who lost on November 3rd.
Sheila, the Secretary of State, Connie Lawson, is insisting on a normal election this fall. She says that we will have a normal election, will not be expanding mail-in voting amid the pandemic. How would you rate Indiana right now in terms of how easy it'll be for people to vote in November?
I think it really probably varies across the state depending upon the county. But let's just say that I find Lawson's protestations unpersuasive.
Elizabeth Bennion, a lot of your work is focused on what does and does not work to mobilize voters. How much is the conventional thinking about that changing because of the circumstances that we're in?
Well, we know that face-to-face mobilization approaches are particularly effective, and there is a lot less opportunity to do that kind of work these days because of the pandemic. The good news is that chatty phone calls that don't sound professionalized and scripted are also quite effective, and peer-to-peer social media outreach can be effective as well. And so candidates are adapting, civic organizations and voting rights advocates are adapting to try to reach people where they are.
Did we learn anything interesting from the primary election that we had in June and what voter turnout looked for that? Elizabeth?
Well, I think one of the things we saw is that people who had the opportunity to vote by mail took advantage of that opportunity, which suggests that a number of people did appreciate that option. The other thing we know is people will get disappointed in the primary and that there weren't more people voting. But many ordinary voters think of primaries as a place where party leaders and party insiders make decisions and then they plan to vote in the fall. So we always see a much bigger turnout in the general election. And that's why it makes sense to think about voter security, but also ballot access and how we can get all of those people to efficiently and effectively cast their ballots.
Is the difference, Elizabeth, between the turnout in the primary, and if we want to get specific, this year's primary, is the difference between a primary and a general, especially during a presidential election year? I mean, is that big enough for us to look at the primary and be able to not be able to predict how the general election will go as far as turnout and participation and security and things like that?
Well, it is at a completely different scale. And one of the things we know is that primary voters they are not a portrait in miniature of the general electorate. And so they tend to be more engaged, more involved, more ideological than the electorate as a whole. So it will really be a turnout game. And you have a lot more voters and a lot more voters who are less familiar with the process who participate in November. So public education about the rules and how to cast a ballot in a way that it will be counted is critically important. So as much as voting rights advocates want to have as many people as possible vote by mail if they will otherwise skip voting altogether, we do need to be concerned about the fact that folks will need to get those ballots in the mail earlier. They may be disenfranchised through that very means that folks were hoping to use to enfranchise them.
And indeed, the deadline this year for that, we're looking at, I believe, October 27th for that to get ballots in the mail if you are voting absentee here in Indiana. Matthew Bennion, what do you think things are going to look like on election night compared to previous elections this year?
I think it's quite possible on election night this year that we will not have final results on all races, potentially even the presidential race, at the end of the night, and that we might have to wait a day or two or three afterwards before we really know a final vote tally and a final decision. And I think that's because with many states increasing the number of mail-in ballots this year, some states for the first time processing those, the local election officials will just have to take a little more time to process and count ballots and make sure that everything's counted correctly before they announce things. And I think that's to be expected. I think that's a perfectly acceptable kind of process to expect, that there will be a bit more processing time involved and that we might not have that big moment of announcement on the night of the election.
Do you foresee it taking perhaps as long as the 2000 election when we were waiting weeks and weeks for a final result?
I don't think so. I think what we're looking at here is, you know, increasing by a couple of days, maybe in a few election precincts or counties, maybe a week or two. But I don't think we're going to see a huge time lag. But I do think it's important to keep in mind that we could see this time lag of up to a couple of weeks, and that during that time period, members of the general public who are looking at that play out need to not freak out about it. There's been a lot of statements made in the national media by national figures sort of casting a sense of doubt or sowing the seeds of distrust about a process where we might not have a decision on election night. And I think that's wrong to think in those terms. I mean, you know, democracies thrive on trust, and especially trust in how governmental institutions and organizations are run. And in this case, you know, our elections are run, you know, at the local level, you know, at states and then at the sort of local voting precinct and county office level. And the people who are running those offices and counting votes, I mean, these are career civil servants who care a great deal about running fair and accurate elections. So if it takes a couple extra days or even a couple of extra weeks, what that means is those people who care a lot about fair and accurate elections are doing their jobs correctly to make sure that the count is fair and accurate. And the public should really keep that in mind and not become concerned if we don't know election results on election night.
Today we're talking about the voting process in the upcoming election with a live panel of political science experts. Sheila Kennedy is a professor at IUPUI. Elizabeth Bennion is a professor at IU South Bend. Matthew Begetta, who we've just been speaking with, is an associate professor at IU. Marjorie Hershey is professor emeritus of political science at IU. Matthew, I'm going to stick with you. There's a pandemic happening right now, of course. So what are some specific ways this election and the process of voting and counting votes will indeed look very different this year?
Well, part of the process of casting votes will be quite different. In some states, there will be, you know, quite a few more mail-in ballots, and so the process of counting those will be different. I mean, the actual steps that they will take to verify the authenticity of a ballot will be the same as they've always been. There just will be more of them. So election officials will have to spend more time counting them and comparing signatures and doing those kinds of things. In terms of voting in person, I expect to see more people voting early in states that have the opportunity for people to do that. Mm. And so we will have more people who are out there at in-person locations casting their ballots ahead of time. So we may well start to see more longer voting lines, you know, several days, maybe even several weeks in advance of Election Day. And then actually on the day of the election, We will, again, you know, see lots of people out. But with the extra time that it might take to cast ballots because of extra protective measures that are put in places, or the literally just the extra space between voters as people wait in line, we will probably see longer lines outside of polling places actually on Election Day. So the actual visuals of this will be quite different, and then the timing of counting afterwards could be quite different. But it's important to remember that the actual process, the casting of ballots, whether it's in person or the casting of ballots through the mail and then the counting of all of those ballots on the back end, is still going to happen in the same way that election officials have been doing this for a very long time.
Marjorie Hershey, I want your help with some clarification here. We heard earlier that Secretary of State Connie Lawson has rejected the idea of expanding vote by mail in Indiana, but absentee voting is still happening. So is what's the difference between voting by mail and absentee voting?
Okay, good. Let me first, before I answer that, amplify something that Matt said. There is a possibility for some pernicious activity here. And the reason is that if we have a whole lot more people voting by mail than is usual, and if the president, as he has so regularly, has claimed that voting by mail is a fraudulent thing to do, and therefore we've seen in recent polls that many more Democrats plan to vote by mail than Republicans do, then if that turns out to be the case, which it probably will, it may well be that some of the Democratic areas will be reporting their results more slowly because of the fact that they have all these mail ballots to count. And President Trump has already stated, well, just wait and see after the election. Once they know what they're dealing with, these Democrats are going to come up with all these extra votes that they are somehow going to magic out of nothing and steal the election. So I think we all need to be prepared in advance for the fact that it's entirely possible that the Democratic vote could grow after election night, simply because of the fact that more Democrats are going to be voting by mail than Republicans are, not because of fraud, but just because it's just a no-brainer that in a pandemic, it does make sense to stay away from crowds. Okay,
well,
so the difference between...
Sure. Go ahead.
Shall we go back to voting by mail and absentee voting?
Indeed. What's the difference?
They are the same in practice. What's different is, I mean, when you're casting a ballot, you're casting a ballot, whether it's absentee or by mail. They're both absentee by mail ballots. The difference involves whether or not the state follows the practice of automatically sending applications for mail ballots to all registered voters, or in fact sending ballots to all registered voters, or whether, as is the case in Indiana, you have to put the burden of proof on the voter to take the extra step and put in the extra effort to request an absentee ballot or a vote by mail. When you do that, of course, again, it's a no-brainer. When you add more work to the voter, you're going to get less voting. So that's the only difference.
What do you think of the list of 11 excuses that you need to vote by mail in Indiana, Marjorie?
Well, I think that we ought to eliminate all of them and say, if you want to vote by mail, you ought to vote by mail. I mean, voting is not a privilege in the United States. Voting is a right. And when we make it more difficult for people to exercise that right, we get fewer of them doing it. Now, it certainly is possible, and in fact, the Secretary of State has sort of hinted at this, that people could fudge their answers to those 11 qualifications, that it doesn't ask you if, in fact, you're going to be out of the county on Election Day, but rather if you believe you're going to be out of the county on Election Day. And so I suppose people who get very guilty about these things might be able to say, well, there's a certain possibility that I might be out of the county on Election Day. But I do think it's kind of foolish for an election administration to encourage people to have to fudge the truth in order to exercise their citizens' right.
We've just got a little bit of time left, about a minute. Surely there is an advantage or a perceived advantage from one side or the other, maybe from the state's point of view, in having these strict rules that inevitably cut down on the number of absentee ballots. What would that advantage be? Marjorie?
I don't know that there is one. Mm. I mean, it might be that others might have a different answer, but yeah, absentee balloting and voting by mail does take a lot of steps to ensure that it is legitimate, as of course we all want to see happen. But that's sort of what we have election officials for.
Anyone have a follow-up that they can make in about 15 to 30 seconds on that?
I think the only advantage, go ahead.
Go ahead, Matthew.
No, please. Okay, I would say that if you look at who uses mail-in ballots and absentee ballots now, those are balloting techniques that require extra effort. So generally speaking, we see older, more educated people who take advantage of absentee ballots, and lower income and racial ethnic minorities are less likely to use those. So if there's any sort of disparity built into those things, it's that we are likely to see absentee ballots used by older and more educated people than the general electorate.
We're going to keep talking to our panel about voting, the voting process. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Back now to our discussion on the voting process behind the upcoming election. We would love your questions and comments for the discussion today. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana and leave a comment there. Or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have a great panel with us today of political science expert Sheila Kennedy, professor at the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI. Elizabeth Bennion is professor of political science at IU South Bend. Matthew Baghetta is an associate professor at the O'Neill School at IU. And Marjorie Hershey is professor emeritus of political science at Indiana University. So, Sheila, are there any good resources that you would recommend for people in Indiana to learn about the rules and processes we have here?
Yes, there really are. There are a couple, well, more than a couple. This year, people have produced web resources that lay out not just, you know, they're not just encouraging people to vote, but they tell you, click here to find out if you're registered. Click here to find out who's running in your particular city or town or, and of course, country, what their platforms are, where your voting place is. It is possible to get the sort of education that was referenced earlier from a number of these sites, and one of them is Indiana Citizen, but I think there are several others, and it's Ballotpedia, of course, does this nationally, but it is easy in this day and age digitally to find every piece of information you really need and to do it from the comfort of your computer. So the explosion of those sorts of resources ought to help us, excuse the expression, goose up turnout in November.
How would you recommend people vote? Not candidate, but method, I guess. How would you recommend people vote if they could choose an option, any option?
Oh, you know, I think that is a really personal choice, and that's why I agree that we should get rid of the 11 excuses and just let people vote by mail if they want to. Everyone's position or situation is different. Those of us who are older and presumably more likely to get the COVID if we go out may feel more secure voting from home. In a more rational world and a more reasonable year, I think I certainly enjoyed going to the polls and seeing neighbors and friends and putting that little sticker on that I voted, did you, or whatever that sticker says. I think it's a personal decision. That what we need to make people understand, however, is that every vote counts. We hear so much, and it's all true, by the way, about gerrymandering and partisan redistricting, but a great number of the area seats that people think, well, this is a safe seat for the other party, so I'm not going to bother to cast my ballot. If everybody came out and voted, a lot of those supposedly safe districts would no longer be safe districts because they are drawn on the basis of prior year's turnouts. So we just need to get people to understand that their vote counts and that it is a duty of citizenship.
Elizabeth, how important is public education about all this? I mean, how much education is needed?
Well, I think there can never be too much. Number one, people do need to understand how extraordinarily difficult it is to undermine the process through fraud, because this is not a federally run election process. It is run at the local and county level, and so we really do have lots of checks and balances in place, and it would be incredibly difficult, as the FBI and Homeland Security has just said, to actually infiltrate the system. So on that macro level, people need some understanding, but also in terms of how to cast their vote, where to cast their vote, when to cast their vote. We know that voters are more likely to actually turn out on election day if they make a plan. And so thinking about how you will cast your ballot, when and where you'll cast your ballot is critically important. And some of the information can be confusing for people. So if a person has a mail-in ballot but doesn't get it in the mail in time and realizes, wow, if the post office is slowed down and it's only 2 days before the election, my ballot might not get there, where do they go? Well, the Indiana statute will say to the election board, but in practice, it is usually the clerk, but sometimes the voter registration office. And if you try to go to our local county clerk, that building is closed. Who knows that they have to knock on a door, ask a security guard to go in on election day, right? This is rather convoluted and unexpected. And so it's complicated, and every single county needs to be working with voters, working with government officials, but also working with civic groups to really not just get out the vote, but get this educational piece in place so people can make a plan that actually will work on or before Election Day.
I mean, Elizabeth, what would you say is the biggest challenge behind getting everyone educated about voting?
Well, certainly, you know, with only a little over 20% of people actually voting in the primary, and those are the folks who vote all the time, we have a large number of voters who are very occasional voters, who vote every 2 years, maybe every 4 years. And so reaching these voters and making sure that they know what they need to know can be a challenge. And that's particularly true in a year where we don't have large face-to-face public gatherings where you can reach a lot of people at the same time. And so it's important for candidates to remember that as they may be reaching out to persuade people how to vote, they need to join nonpartisan civic groups in helping to educate people how to vote, because we really need every person who is encouraging turnout to also include this educational piece. And luckily, there are a lot of great resources online this year. So whether people go to turbovote.com or vote411.org or to indianavoters.com, which is really the Secretary of State's election portal, they can see who's on their ballot. They can, in some cases like vote411, learn about those candidates on their ballot. They can see where their local polling place is or their nearest voting center. They can check their registration status, which is incredibly important because some people don't realize they've been purged. And so folks really need to know how to do these things to make sure that they protect their valuable right and privilege of voting.
Matthew Begetta, this summer we've seen a lot of skepticism from some about how much we can trust the election process. And indeed, we've already talked about some of it this hour. I mean, what do you think is causing that?
Well, I think some of it is by design, that there are national political figures who, you know, have been trying to, you know, sow the seeds of distrust, to get people to get just a little bit of doubt in their mind about whether or not, you know, our election process is secure. And, you know, even without any evidence to support that, just getting the idea out there over and over again is enough to, you know, perhaps make some people uneasy. And I think that's why it's so important that a number of the strategies that we've talked about so far this hour are really important, that local organizations across the political spectrum, right, local organizations that are aware of what's going on locally, you know, can communicate with their members and with the people who participate in those organizations and let them know, you know, what's going on here locally is totally normal, is totally fine. Like, the people who have run our elections for the last 25 or 30 or 40 years, the professionals that you know who have been in those county offices for a long time are the same people for this election that have been there before. And we should have every bit as much trust in their ability to count a vote this year as we had in their ability to count a vote last year or even just a few months ago if you had, say, a special election or the primary election. If you trusted the outcome of the primary, you should trust the outcome of the vote counts that are going on for the national election. And so I think there is a bulwark against some of that national messaging, and it is our broad network of, you know, local government offices and local organizations who can connect directly with local voters and let them know, yes, you can trust the election system. Be calm about this. Be rational about this. The votes are going to be counted correctly.
We're talking with a live panel of political science experts on the voting process behind the upcoming election. And if you'd like to jump into the conversation, we've got a little bit of time left. You can do it on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana and leave a comment there. Matthew Baghetta, I have a follow-up. So, I mean, there is some blatant misinformation out there about how the election process works, but there's also plenty of evidence from elections in this country that things don't always go well. Are there certain things we should worry about?
Yes, absolutely. Fraud is not one of them. We have no evidence that there's, you know, widespread attempts at voter fraud. But we definitely have concerns about vote access, right? There are barriers to voting. There are barriers to voting in a totally normal year where there is no pandemic, where everything is running normally. It's hard for many people to get out to vote on election day. We have seen in recent elections, like, huge lines, people waiting hours and hours. People are now offering advice to people in some voting precincts to bring not one but two meals with them so that they have something to eat all day long while they wait in line to vote in person, right? Like, there are substantial barriers. If we really want to focus on something, on making this a truly free and fair election, we should be really focused on lowering barriers to access. Some of that can be done through the widespread access to no-excuse-required mail-in ballots of the kinds we've talked about. Some of that can be done through expanding early voting. I would actually love to hear, I mean, if the state of Indiana goes the way that it has said so far, which is it's not going to expand mail-in voting, I would like to hear more from the state about efforts to expand early in-person voting and the kinds of things that will happen to make those polling places both more available and accessible and safer prior to Election Day. Because I think that's another excellent way to spread out the voting process so that things are less risky and more people can participate. So lowering the barriers to entry into the voting process. And again, on election day, we want to see that kind of thing as well. Anything we can do to lower the barrier to voting, the better off we're going to be. And that's sort of where the real concern for me lies.
What was your follow-up?
I'd like to add something to that. Another real advantage to mail-in voting is you have a paper trail. One of the reasons, I think, for the distrust that Matt has so correctly referenced is because as so much of the country has gone to electronic voting machines, there's been a real concern about hacking, and it's not a totally unfounded concern either. So the fact that vote by mail gives you it does two things. It prevents some of the voter suppression activities that have been around for a very long time. Minority neighborhoods that have a suddenly have a police presence around the polling place. I remember those days here in Indianapolis. So if you're voting by mail, those kinds of vote suppression tactics no longer work. But the great virtue is you have a paper trail. So if there is a close election for county sheriff or whatever, you can go back and count the ballots and be confident that nobody's gotten in there and hacked them. And those voting machines, I'm sure, have become more secure over time, but there's a great deal of mistrust. And I think, that's another great virtue of vote by mail.
Sheila Kennedy, thank you for that follow-up. We have a listener voicemail that I want to get to from Dale. Let's listen.
This is Dale. I'm calling from Columbus, and I'm curious if anyone knows the history of absentee or mail-in voting in Indiana. How long have we had it, and has it, other than last spring, have there been other changes over the years in terms of how it's handled and what the rules are? Thanks.
Marjorie Hershey, are you the one to answer Dale's question?
No, I'm not, actually. I don't have a clue about that.
Anybody else on the panel? Elizabeth?
Nope.
Matthew? Do we know anything about the history?
I don't know many details about the history. I do know that the state has had, absentee balloting for a very long time, and it is something that the state has plenty of experience with doing. In every election in my memory in this state, there has been the availability of absentee balloting, and so it's not that it is a new thing, and the processes are in place for processing those kinds of ballots. So while I don't know a lot of the detailed history behind that, I would say the relevant history in terms of being able to run an election now with mail-in ballots would suggest that we've got all the capacity and historical experience necessary in order to do it.
Elizabeth Bennion, is it inevitable in some ways that efforts to increase security and efforts to increase voter access are going to conflict?
I think that rhetorically and politically, people make it seem as if they are it's a zero-sum game. But in fact, we know that's not true, because mail-in ballots, for example, can increase access for people who have trouble getting to the polling place or in a pandemic might not feel safe doing so. But there are security measures in place. It's just important for people to have time to get their barcodes and their signature and their ballot sleeves and things ready and get a process in place that makes it not less but more secure, as we just heard, in terms of having that paper trail, which some counties lack in their in-person voting polling places. Similarly, when we talk about access, we're talking about how can we expand early voting sites. Well, the more workers you have and the more opportunities you have to spread out and actually take your time with each voter, the more that you're improving the accuracy of the election. You're checking to make sure that voter is where they need to be and that they're a legitimate voter, and you're giving them the opportunity to vote when it's not so crowded and they're not in such a long line. And so just a couple of the things we've heard explain how these things can actually be very compatible. And I think it is for the purpose of politicizing these discussions that they sometimes are pitted against each other as if they cannot both coexist.
Well, I wish we had more time, but that's about it for today. I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Sheila Kennedy is professor at the Paul H. O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at IUPUI. Thanks to you, Sheila.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Bennion is professor of political science at IU South Bend. Thanks to you, Elizabeth. Matthew Baghetta is an associate professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Marjorie Hershey is professor emeritus of political science at Indiana University. And our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you for listening. This is All In.